Blog Talk Radio.
Take my love, take my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me. Take me out to the black. Tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea. You can't take the sky from me. There's no place I can be since I found serenity. You can't take the sky from me.
Good evening. You are live with Tex and Rex. Irreverent, relevant, and radioactive conservatism with a bite. I'm your host, Rex, broadcasting to you from the Ninth Circle of Hell, otherwise known as I-495, the Capitol Beltway.
And this is Tex, broadcasting from high above Houston in the Crystal Cathedral. How are you, Tex? Or Rex, whoever you are?
I'm all right, considering I'm near Washington, D.C., and we've got the special 11 o'clock show tonight post the vice presidential so-called debate, and we're going to be doing a little debate analysis and whatever else comes our way. Call-in number is 646-649-1013. Repeat, 646-649-1013. Rules are simple, no blasphemy on the air, and do not attack our guests unless they allow you to, but feel free to attack the hosts. If you are a Joe Biden fan and you think that Joe Biden did a good job mopping the floor with Paul Ryan tonight, call in. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you are a Paul Ryan fan and you think that he really gave a wallop to Joe Biden, call in. And if you're a Jack Ryan fan, I strongly think that the Tom Clancy books are quite excellent. If you like anybody else, call us and let us know what you're thinking, because my impression, Tex, was that, this debate was more exciting and substantive than the so-called presidential debate. But, you know, these guys have been, and I mean, it's like an open secret now, they've been rehearsing their lines. They've been preparing for the debate. You know, basically the Commission on Presidential Debates has a contract with the Republicans and the Democrats to disallow any other voices, and we know that there are at least four other candidates who all have enough ballot access to qualify for 270 electors, and they prepare the questions and make sure that nothing gets, you know, too ruffled or denies the discussion and the narrative of duopoly. But you know, what did you see, Tex?
Well, I saw, you know, pretty much the same thing. One thing about it being, you know, rehearsed, well, let me give you my overall impression of the debate, you know, just starting out to the finish, which is they came out of the gate. They were talking about Libya, and so Biden did not do well on that topic, I didn't think. Ryan was all over him. And that's when Biden was smiling at sort of inappropriate times, which, you know, I always kind of give people a pass on the body language stuff because, you know, you're looking at them on television, but you're not in the presence, and so there are other dynamics going on. But then about, you know, 25, 30 minutes in maybe, Biden started really to assert himself, so I got on to other topics, and just kind of, in my opinion, made mincemeat out of Paul Ryan, and not by, like, zingers and attacks. I mean, the bad thing was a lot of it was substantive, you know, which is, you know, Ryan's supposed to be the substance guy, and Biden was coming out looking more substantive, but on the, you know, it's rehearsed thing, I mean, of course it's going to be. You don't just send your candidate out there and not have him rehearse anything. So I'm not, you know, that upset that they rehearsed what they needed to say about this stuff. But there was an interesting moment early on when Biden said that, you know, Obama had worked with Russia and China and world leaders to get these devastating, devastating on the economy, right? And it's like he spaced the word. And then he went into Iran. I was like, oh, he's talking about the Iranian oil sanctions, right? Oh, okay, that's what he meant. But you could tell he spaced the word. And then I think Ryan gave it to him the next time. He's like, yes, so these sanctions are like, oh, okay, that was the word that you forgot. But he only sort of did that once. It wasn't like a full Rick Perry moment. And he never said oops or anything stupid like that.
Oops.
You could tell, like, he had memorized that answer. And then he's like,
yeah.
Oh, no, I forgot the next line.
Yeah,
so,
you know, the rule in show business, which is what this was, a stage show, is the show must go on. We're familiar with this because neither one of us knows what the fuck we're doing on radio, but we do it every night. I thought the really interesting part was when Joe Biden ripped up Paul Ryan's class schedule, and Paul Ryan looked at him and said,
you dick!
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, that was Spicoli and Mr. Hand. You know, sometimes I forget when I'm watching fact or fiction, considering that these days apparently they sell us fiction as fact. I think it was the way it was supposed to go. I think it was supposed to be a mild nod to Joe Biden because of the knockout punch that Mitt Romney delivered to Obama in the last so-called debate. You know, again, the idea here is they're trying to keep it even because they need us to think that there's a chance that our guy is going to win, whoever our guy
I have a guy
happens
in this
to
election.
Be. Well, yeah, apparently, you know, we have a guy in this election. His name is Speaker Newt Gingrich, Dr. Ron Paul, but apparently
the guy pulling all the weight for the Republican Party trying to pull it out of the ditch.
Yeah.
These two idiots up here, you know, screwing it up.
Yep. But again, it highlights, I mean, go back to the Republican primary so-called debates. I mean, those are obviously not as rehearsed. I mean, the guys practice their little lines, but it's certainly more legitimately a debate. But, of course, you know, you have 30 seconds to answer this complex question, so it's more like, you know, soundbite crap. But just remember all the stuff that we got from Newt Gingrich and even, you know, Ron Paul, of course. Sometimes it's hard to follow Ron Paul unless you happen to understand Austrian economics. So for a lot of people, he just seemed to drone on about stuff that they've never heard of. But just take Newt Gingrich as an example. If he was up there against Biden, it would have been completely over. And if he was up against Obama last time, I mean, come on. It goes without saying. And I remember, Tex, back when we were telling people, you got to run Gingrich. Gingrich is the guy. The media is going to be so one-sided in this. The only chance that the conservative message is going to get out is during the debates. And they're like, we're looking for a debater-in-chief. Well, you know, come on. Wouldn't
maybe
we be winning this election?
Something about something. Which
yeah,
Romney
but
doesn't
we
seem to really have any skill set when it comes to government. Or being a politician, he's a terrible politician. He's an embarrassing politician. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, he doesn't have. I mean, you're right. When you bring up skill set, his skill set is to basically raid companies and you know, do leverage buyouts and make a lot of money, you know, doing that, which is a completely different skill set than it takes to one get your message across a hostile media, because conservatism isn't popular in the Republican Party. Sure as hell isn't popular in the Democratic Party. To get your message out succinctly, to speak to people in language that they can understand, make the points, and be able to counter any arguments, no one does it better than Gingrich. And he would have, hands down, already won this election. I think we'd be looking
Absolutely.
At, you know, somewhere around 330 electors, you know, versus Obama at maybe somewhere in the 160s. Instead, we got, what, Romney at, like, you know, 190-something and Obama at 265. I mean, it's embarrassing. It's ridiculous. But I guess the intention here is to either reelect Obama, given that maybe the Republicans know something bad is coming and they don't want to be blamed for it, or B, to you know, cheat and put Romney in there so that the Republicans will all sit back and go, whew, glad that's over. The Obama nightmare is over, and now we've got our guy in there, and everybody will go home and stuff their face with Cheetos, and the Goldman Sachs agenda will continue. So, again, just like with the last debate, if you want to ask me who the winner was, I would say the winner is Goldman Sachs. Tex, we got a caller already. Shall I bring them on.
If I can, you know, carry on for
please
a little bit. Yeah. Now, in the first debate, Romney may have won. You know, I thought Obama had a pretty lackluster performance. But Romney, I watched the thing and I was looking for some specifics. What are you going to do, Romney, if you, you know, how are you going to fix this? He spent a lot of time saying, you're terrible at this, you're terrible at this, and I would be better. Okay, why would you be better? But see, he doesn't really ever follow up. He'll just say, I have a plan. Okay, you know, don't worry, I got a plan. You can't see it yet, but I got a plan, you know. So I think Romney won the first one, but it was sort of a hollow victory because he didn't get into specifics. Now, interestingly, Paul Ryan did get into specifics. And the funny thing is, this vice presidential debate was the most specific one I've heard in months, you know, where they were actually talking about specific details of what was going on. I mean, they were talking about, you know, the drawdown plan in Afghanistan. It's like, oh, yeah, I remember when politicians used to inform me of things so that I understood them and knew what the hell was going on. I mean, so, you know, Romney may have won the first one, but I don't think it really helped himself because, as we talked about earlier in the week with Mike, people just have a confirmation bias when they see what they mm-hmm. wanted to see. So if you're getting a bunch of vacuous responses without an argument, then people don't change their mind. And this goes back to what Gingrich was saying in one of his speeches, that you can mm-hmm. win by running our guy versus their guy. You have to run our vision of the world versus their vision of the world. And Romney did not advance another vision. All he said was Obama's vision is wrong. And I think the inherent problem that they're having is when it comes to things like Syria, when it comes to things like Afghanistan, that Afghanistan section was brutal for Ryan.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was like, well, I don't think we should arbitrarily get out of there by 2014. And Biden's like, it wasn't arbitrary. We sat down, we talked to these guys, and I said, let's get out by 2014. He's like, yeah, but you're pulling all these troops out. You pulled them out of East Afghanistan. And he said, well, yeah, we trained a bunch of Afghanistani soldiers who moved them over there, and they're fighting for that. He's like, yeah, but you pulled out, you know, the troops. He said, yeah, American, you know. And it was like, yeah. And then he said, well, what is your problem with 2014? You want to go beyond 2014? It's like, no, I don't want to go beyond 2014. Like, why are you complaining about it? Well, because we shouldn't say what the date is because they'll wait us out. Okay, so do you want to stay longer? It's like, no. So what is your policy that's different in Afghanistan? What is the Romney-Ryan policy? It isn't different. I'll tell you, this is why when Barack Obama got elected, he said all these great things about foreign policy, and he came in and he enacted the George Bush foreign policy. It's because it's already plugged in, man. That thing's hardwired.
You know?
Yeah. Spoiler alert, they don't disagree. They're just trying to find what's going on and a way to spin it that sounds bad, but when they get in, they're doing the same stuff.
Well, it's a minor rhetorical difference, and I think you're absolutely right. That's what they give us. They give us minor rhetorical difference with a nod on one side to the, you know, tree-hugging, peacenik, you know, one earth, you know, liberal mentality, and on the other side they give a nod to, you know, strong national defense, American patriotism, American exceptionalism, you know, lower taxes, smaller government. But the fact is that I know that they've been playing this game for a long time, and very few people have seen it, and now more people are seeing it, but I don't think I've ever seen them run two such incompetent campaigns that are ideologically, policy-wise, so close to each other. I mean, I could spot some differences between Al Gore and George Bush. In fact, in 99, George Bush sounded very much like Dr. Ron Paul, and so there were stark differences in what was going on. And then, you know, we got more or less the opposite policies. We got more debt. We got more spending, and we got more wars. It was fantastic. And then, of course, that brought us the Hopi Changey Obama thing, which was, you know, I'm going to George Bush is terrible. I'm going to do everything differently. And if I'm not mistaken, unless you've got some kind of rose-colored spectacles on or some serious confirmation bias, pretty much everything Obama has done is all the bad stuff George Bush did magnified. And to believe for a second that somehow Romney's going to change this, I mean, it was pathetic. I found it to be...
Romney's a big change agent for Washington.
Yeah.
And he's going to fix it. They're yeah. afraid up there at Washington how much change is going to happen. I mean, they're
well,
first, they don't even think that Romney's going to be showing up, so they've already written him off, right? But, you know, if he did, they were like, yeah, whatever, it'll be Romney. He won't know what's going on. We'll just, you know, be nice to him and everything. We'll just tell him what to do, and he'll okay it.
Yeah. Well, I hear that the debates are showing such massive confirmation bias that in the next presidential debate, Daniel Day-Lewis is going to play Mitt Romney and Webster is going to play Barack Obama, and apparently the American people can't tell the difference.
Danielle Day-Lewis?
Danielle Day-Lewis is going to play Mitt Romney. He's going to have to play a little bit less animated than usual.
I wish we had that clip, man. That's hilarious, but yes. Daniel
it is historical.
Lewis.
We'll have to run that
for
sometime.
For his famous screaming scene.
Yeah, we've got a text on the line. We have a soft-spoken, somewhat shy Marine who, you know, has probably something interesting to say about this contest, but, you know, we got to draw him out. Randy from Constitutionally Correct, the vice chairman of the Constitution Party, is live with Tex and Rex. Hey, Randy, how are you?
Hey, Randy, how's it going?
Good evening, gentlemen. And you left out introverted.
Oh, yes, introverted.
Oh, yes. Do you want to read us one of the poetries that you've written? No,
all I can tell you is I will not go quietly into the night. How's that for poetry?
Good start. I like that one.
Oh, man, you know, I just got off of I just came over from Bard's interview with Pippi Longstocking and Mr. Garlic or whoever they were. I forget. No,
Pepper Draper and Richard Gilbert. I'm sure they appreciate the references.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't do that. But
yeah. It's Tex and Rex. There are no rules here, Randy, so have at it. If friendlies can't take the fire, then, you know.
You know what was funny is back when I ran for governor in 2006, there was some pretty derogatory comments. And as I'm watching this stuff, I just had to start laughing. And I told him, I said, you know, if you all weren't so deluded, I'd be laughing my ass off right now. And which really caught the guy's attention because he never dreamed that he was talking about, you know, derogatorily who I was and my run for the governor's office. And he never dreamed I would come into his blog and address it. And what was funny about it was I gained a lot of respect for coming in here and saying, man, I thought that stuff was pretty funny. And but anyway.
I mean, I think people, you get criticism when people just, you know, oh, my God, cold shoulder or hold, you know, a grudge or something. I mean, I like to go in and duke it out, you know. I mean, people are people. And, you know, a good battle of ideas is always worth having, you know. And, I mean, if they already don't like you, they still don't like you, but maybe you can win them over.
Yeah, you never know. Which is why I try to be careful about trying to, you know, swing and knock people out. You know, I'm a little tight for my opinions and all, but you know, I try not to take the proverbial 4x4 and beat them over the head, knock them out. My wife has been trying to help me in this regard. Some of it's taken.
Socratic method is key.
Yeah, you know, some of it's taken. It's just taken, you know, so far it's been, I've been out of the Marine Corps for almost 10 years now. And, well, anyway, you know, one of the things that they were talking about over there in the other show with these folks, were they talking about, you know, come back home to the Republican Party. We're taking over the party. And I'm like, you know what? Even if that were true, and I'm saying, even if it's true, I'll give you the benefit of that. Even if that's true, the fact of the matter is there is a two-party duopoly. And even if there wasn't a quote-unquote duopoly, even if they were totally separate and there really was competition in the political arena, the fact that two parties could somehow in any way, shape, or form represent the plethora of political ideas and stuff is absolute insanity, and it forces people to be what they call rhinos. I would be considered a rhino. Even in their best moments with the Republican Party, I would probably still be considered a rhino because I don't subscribe to all their policies. And I want somebody that actually does, that I can vote for in my conscience. And so, you know, even if they were true and they were taking over the Republican Party, the fact is that we need a multi-party system, because the fact of two parties, number one, eliminates true choice. Number two, still allows for the idea of corruption to take its foothold in there, because again, you're how many times are you going to be forced with the lesser of two evils instead of the greater of two choices? And, you know, we need to be able to destroy the duopoly. I'm not here to destroy the Republican or Democrat parties. While I certainly don't ascribe to a big part of what either one of those parties uphold anymore, the fact is that we need choice. And it is only when we level the playing field and allow choices on the political arena that we will actually be able to start, in my opinion, start truly tackling the premises behind where corruption gets its foothold.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, Randy. And, you know, one of the problems that, you know, you talk about people who want to come back home to the Republican Party. We know we just kicked you in the nuts and told you to go to hell and nominated Romney, but time to come home to the Republican Party.
Tex, I don't think that's what Pepper Draper and Richard Gilbert would have advocated. Remember, they were both pro Ron Paul. So I think it's an issue of that from the grassroots level, the Ron Paul Liberty Movement is taking over large swaths of the Republican Party. So it's not come back home to the party that just kicked the shit out of us. It's come back home to the party that you thought that the Republicans were. And
I
agree with
Rex. I want to say
go ahead.
Which is that, you know, you do need, I mean, because, look, the Ron Paul movement and, you know, sort of the liberty movement writ large that includes people in the Constitution Party, you know, people even in the Libertarian Party, which is like a huge amorphous group of support, and other parties as well, that's sort of the majority of America and where Americans want to be. That's why independents are 40% of the vote, more than Democrats and more than Republicans, right? Because people want to go back to that. They want a more limited government. But the problem is that the Republican Party, the leadership anyway, I think they saw the Ron Paul movement, and they're like, holy crap, the barbarians are at the gate. We're about to lose control of our party. And so they erected a firewall in that rule that said that the RNC basically picks who the nominee is, and the nominee picks the delegates. Well, how do you go fix a party that just did that to itself? So if you don't change that rule, I mean, it's almost unfixable. I mean, that's what I'm starting. That's like number one. Before you can go back, that rule's got to change.
Well, there's two additional things. Number one, they failed to really recognize, and I would have put some serious money down. Ron Paul and the Republican Party, they're claiming control of 11 states is what they're claiming right now. And the fact of the matter is, in my opinion, if Ron Paul would have chosen to drop from the Republican Party and run in a third party, I don't care if it's Libertarian Constitution Party, or he created a party called the Campaign for Liberty Party or something, I don't care. My opinion is that if he would have chosen to do that, he would be on the ballot in every single state in this union. And
I agree.
And that so, you know, for them to claim that, you know, we must still continue to do it through the Republican Party, in my opinion, is absolute insanity, because they have the ability to minimize and marginalize their efforts. Because and the point I would make on this, and there are things about Ron Paul that I absolutely love and admire, and we in the Constitution Party identify with a good chunk of what Ron Paul espouses. But the fact of the matter is, if you take a look and see what kind of effect, not simply his message. He's had a great message, and certainly he's had some impact on the Federal Reserve issue. But, you know, answer me this question. When is the last time that Ron Paul sponsored a bill that actually got passed or that he actually opposed and got killed? And that will answer to a large degree the actual effect in terms of what he's been able to actually accomplish, not simply a message, but actually what he's been able to accomplish during his time in Congress.
What you're saying is that, I mean, what you're saying is absolutely true, and there's something I'll add to that in a second. But there is something to be said for the person who stood his ground when everybody else was jumping off
the cliff. I absolutely agree with that.
It's the guy who didn't.
However, that
you're making is the reason that I was a Gingrich supporter, because Gingrich got a lot done. And when he became Speaker of the House, he did balance the budget. Now, they'll say, well, he used an accounting trick or whatever. But if you look at real wages in the U.S. for American families at the time, they went up for the first time since, you know, 71, and they started devaluing the dollar. You know, things started getting better when the federal budget was balanced. And so that's why I was a Gingrich person, because he's a guy who can do things. And that's why I thought the perfect ticket for us to run would have been Newt Gingrich, who can go advocate for conservative ideas and be the leading sort of thinker and, you know, guy fighting, our champion, fighting for our ideas. And then you have Ron Paul, who does better talking about the general principles of the Constitution. If you had Gingrich, you would have energized the base. The base would be turning out. So you increase voter turnout with him, immobilize the base thing, Karl Rove, in case you're listening and don't understand how elections work. The leadership would have begrudgingly accepted Gingrich because he's led the party before. And then if you had Ron Paul on there, Ron Paul would broaden the base, because Ron Paul brings in a whole bunch of people who would not even be voting if it weren't for the fact that Ron Paul was on the ballot. And you would have a huge base turnout and a broader base because of Ron Paul. You'd crush. I mean, we would be winning by, you know, 60-40, something like that. Instead of this debacle.
Yeah. But I think that what you're saying, Tex, which is absolutely right, and that's precisely why I was advocating and working hard for Newt Gingrich to get to the brokered convention so that we could have a real conservative at the top of the ticket for a change. But I think that the idea is that you have to credit Ron Paul with inspiring new voters to come to the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And I believe that they are working towards making the Republican Party conservative. Now, the duopoly extends far beyond this election. It isn't even just about the so-called debate that we saw tonight or this election. Duopoly is a mindset that the corporations have been teaching us since we were at school in order to get us to pick A or B. And the problem with either or is that sometimes both choices suck, which means that I want neither nor. And then sometimes choices are good, in which case I don't want either or, I want both and. So I would suggest that for us to reclaim our liberty and restore our Constitution, we need a both and. I think it is extremely wise to continue a grassroots movement to overtake the Republican Party and oust the rhinos, while we also seek third-party options that are more resonant with specific voters. And I agree with you, Randy. We should have more choices. The way to do that is to
third parties to Congress, and then the Republicans would have to work with them.
Exactly. Right? So if you're advocating for third parties based on not just the party itself but on the candidate themselves, then those who are truly meritorious will rise and they will be given positions of authority. And by taking over the Republican Party and making it conservative once again, you will squeeze out the rhinos. Because the fact is, we keep talking about third party. Well, where's the second party? There is no second party. There's one party, and then there's minor parties. So by what the Ron Paul revolution is doing inside the Republican Party is actually making the Republican Party truly one of the two parties as opposed to a single party. And if you have a rising plethora of third-party voices and a conservative Republican Party, because let's face it, you're not gonna have a movement like that in the Democratic Party, then you've now started to tilt the wheel back towards the Constitution. And it is not about just merely this election. This is, as far as I see it, we're kind of like, you know, in the pre-season right now, and November 6th the season hits, because this is the first election where this many people have woken up. And now it's time to push forward, that in the next few election cycles we can start seeing Constitution Party candidates and conservative libertarians elected to offices at the state level and the federal level, and hopefully true conservative Republicans as well. And that's how you change the game.
Well,
I agree.
You talked about broadening the base, and this is being a big turnout for third parties. I wanted to share with you guys something that I saw earlier today, which I think is really interesting. This is Camille Paglia. For those of you who don't know, she writes for Salon Magazine. She's a feminist, but she is not your traditional feminist. She's been very sort of right-wingish in some areas, of course very left-wing in other areas. but she was asked in a recent interview who she was going to vote for, and she said that she's going to vote for the Green Party. Now, the reasoning she gives is kind of interesting. Now, she says that, I mean, first she's got to, go after the candidates. So she says she doesn't like Santorum or Gingrich. Interestingly, she doesn't mention Ron Paul. I was looking for a mention, but she doesn't mention his name. Then she says, but I think that Mitt Romney is a moderate, like Nelson Rockefeller, who as governor of New York poured money into the state university system that educated me. Romney is an affable, successful businessman whose skills seem well-suited to this particular moment of the economic crisis. Hence, I want to use my vote to make a statement about my unhappiness with the Democrat Party and the direction it has taken. The biggest issue for me is the Obama administration's continuation of endless war. So the first reason, there's a big hiatus there, but so the first reason I'm voting green is the state of endless war. Second is the appalling rise in the military and domestic use of drones. I bought Medea Benjamin's protest book about drones, and I agree with her. There's a reason for great concern about the use of drones for police surveillance in the United States. So my third reason for going green is the creeping totalitarianism of Obamacare. Now, this is interesting. This is kind of a right-leaning person who also has a lot of very left-wing views. But my third reason for going green is creeping totalitarianism of Obamacare, which Jill Stein, as a physician, is rightly skeptical about. I began denouncing the Obamacare bill in my Salon column, blah, blah, blah. But she says, what surprises her is the way liberals lay down flat to accept this massive totalitarian takeover of the American medical system was shocking to me. What in the world has happened to the Democrat Party? It's like the movie of H.G. Wells's The Time Machine. The Democrats have turned into the Eloi, and they're like sheep. And then this person says, because it's Salon, so they said, well, I totally agree with you on those subjects, Afghanistan growing surveillance of states. And it seems like these are issues brought up as we raise them. Other progressives raise them a lot. But part of why it never comes up is because the Republicans are completely complicit and would likely be worse in both of those cases. That's what the questioner says. Now, she says, wait a minute, hold it, no, listen, a huge point I want to make is that the protest against the surveillance state has, with only a few exceptions, been mainly coming from the right and not from the left. Talk radio has been seething with this issue for years. A good example of talk show is Mark Levin's Liberty and Tyranny, which is number one New York Times bestseller 3 years ago. And yet got very few mainstream reviews. Democrats have to wake up. This is why the Republican Party has gained while the Democrat Party is in disarray. Why has the GOP become the Freedom Party? Over the past 10 years, I'm coming to an end. The freedom has become a conservative watchword, thank you, Ron Paul, and liberals have lost their claim to it. So I thought it was interesting that here you have someone who has kind of a grab bag of views, but traditionally would vote Democrat, but is completely disillusioned with the Democrat Party, and now they're leaving the two-party duopoly as well, all of which indicates to me that there is a large, unsatisfied, sort of roiling discontent with the political elites in our country and our elected officials and where they're taking the country.
Man, that is powerful. It is really powerful. You know, I was driving down the road with my dad, heading to some political event or another, and I was actually listening to the liberal radio station, NPR, and they were talking about some issues. I'm like, Dad, do you hear what they're saying? I actually agree with them. They were talking about the use of money being a bludgeoning tool. You know, they were talking about, you know, how they have allowed all of these PACs to have unlimited funding. And the statement was, this is not an expression of freedom. This is right. A trampling of
yep.
the freedom and of expression and the ability to get the message out. It bludgeons it. And I was like, Dad, I've been saying that. And for these people to come up with this. And so, you know, and it also indicates, while there's certainly some, you know, liberal leanings and all of that, the fact is there are still some people who do appreciate the Constitution and the liberties that it provides and the chains that it provides for our federal government.
Right on, Randy. I'm going to go ahead and announce the number because we're at the bottom of the hour. Call in number is 646-649-1013. We've got some callers I'm going to bring on, and I'm going to mute some mics, and I'll bring you back on shortly. One real quick point before I bring in a caller. By the way, if you don't want to be on the line, just say, hey, I just called in to listen, and I will remute your mic. The interesting point about this whole idea is, how am I agreeing with people on the left, and why are people on the right talking about this stuff? And it's because the left-right paradigm is just bunk. And the fact is, we can have divergent views about certain things within the constitutional framework, but duopoly has corrupted our minds so much that we automatically assume somebody on the left is our enemy. Well, when it comes to civil liberties, we shouldn't have an enemy on the left, and committed liberals will actually agree with us on civil liberties issues. But we have to shun them because they're not Republicans. And they might agree with us on civil liberties issues, and they might agree with us on some other points, but they have to shun us because, you know,
yeah,
we're not Democrats.
We're the
not Democrats.
And they're the donkeys, and therefore we
so
can't get along.
Yep, it's exactly. Next, well, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things is, you know, I have some Democrat friends that I grew up with. The district I grew up in was 85% Republican, but apparently I knew every single Democrat in it. But, you know, they were saying that, you know, we were having a conversation, and I was talking about TSA and all this kind of stuff, which I absolutely hate. You know, and I said, you know, this place is just turning into a police state. How the hell did this happen? I mean, we weren't letting them quarter British troops in people's houses and stuff. I mean, what is the same thing? I'm going to go take a trip. You know, now I'm getting strip searched. What the hell's going on? And I think the founding fathers would have put up with any of this crap? No way. And so he said, well, it's interesting that you say that, because a lot of people I know who are Democrats are saying the same thing. And this gets back to what we've been saying consistently, which is that the dominant political conflict of our day now is not between right versus left, elephants versus donkeys. It's between centralized power and diffusion of power, which is why Ron Paul has such a following. Because people are like, the government has grown too large, it's intruded into too many areas, and we need to start getting back to the Constitution and getting away from federalizing every single problem that we have. And so some people in the Republican Party think that Ron Paul goes too far. Some people in the Ron Paul movement think that Newt Gingrich doesn't go far enough. And, you know, my thing is, find people heading in the right direction as far as you're willing to go and start supporting them, and we can, you know, discuss the differences as we move on. But you got to reject the status because, yep. You know, we're too far down the road to keep listening to these guys.
Yeah, we're well on the road to serfdom, and if we don't turn around and go back now, we're all going to become slaves, whether we're right, left, or center. Just brought in a caller from area code 925. 925, you're live with Tex and Rex. What's on your mind, and did you watch the so-called debate tonight?
Hey, it was Tex and Rex. This is Paul. Paul Lucero on the
chat.
Hey, Paul. Hi, guys.
Hey, Paul.
Yeah, I watched the debate. I can't stay away from that stuff. I'm a junkie addicted, and so I guess in some ways, even though I kind of don't want to hear what they have to say in many cases, I can't stay away from it. You know,
it's like watching a car wreck, right? It's just, whoa.
Yeah, you know, it's got a, what do you call them, rubberneck? Rubberneck?
Rubberneck.
Yeah, I'm rubbernecking on the political stuff. You know, my superficial takeaway from the debates is Biden's really a rude dude. Pompous, arrogant, even in just catching a little bit of Frank Luntz on his focus groups, you know, listening to that, because I do enjoy the way he spins things out of there. Consensus that Biden is rude, objectionable, arrogant, But some of the guys, some people liked him. I'm not going to go any farther than that with that. But that to me says very loudly about his influence on the Senate and how it is reacting to anything. His arrogance and his iron fist type control. Again, that's with all due respect to one of our chatters here who comes up as Iron Fist. That tells me volumes, or speaks to me volumes of what the Senate is doing. And it's, I don't think, I don't have a strong affinity for Harry Reid by any means. How the Senate is reacting to what the House is trying to do, and sometimes good things, sometimes not so good things, is the Biden influence in the demeanor and the positions that they take. And that's like very bad in my book. Other than that, on the debates, it wasn't anything I didn't expect. The talking points both were spot on from what I expected them to say about the various talking points. So, it was nothing. I didn't learn anything or see anything other than Paul Ryan can keep his cool better than Joe Biden, which I liked. Right? I'm not saying I like Paul Ryan a lot, but he could keep him cool, which means he's cool under fire for some things. Anyway, I'll stop for a minute. I got some other things to say, but I'll stop for a minute.
Yeah, I thought he was definitely cooler under fire than Biden, but I thought, Biden kind of, he was master of facts and data on that thing, and look, it started out really rocky for Biden. I thought, this is just going to go terrible for Biden. but he really hit his stride. And particularly that exchange they were having about Afghanistan, and Paul Ryan was saying, you said we're going to pull out by 2014. I don't think we should, announce a date and all that kind of stuff. He said, so you think we should stay longer than that? He's like, well, I'm not saying that. And he said, but you're pulling the troops out now. You've pulled, 20,000-30,000 troops out of eastern Afghanistan. He's like, yeah, well, we pulled Americans out, and we replaced them with Afghans that we trained, right? He's like, but you still pulled troops out. Well, yeah, that's part of getting the hell out of there, right? So I thought that was kind of a stupid thing Ryan was saying. And then when pressed about what is that you don't like about 2014, he says, well, it's just setting a date that says we're only going to be here this long, and then after that time you can just wait it out, and we can get the heck out. But then when asked, well, do you not like that pullout date? He said, well, no, I'm fine with it. You know what I'm saying? So that seemed very weak to me.
I thought Biden was very effective at boxing him in and then lowering a hammer with false type of information. I think Paul Ryan hit one point good there in that you don't say what date you're going to pull out and then stick to that date and advertise to your enemies, and because they're just going to wait you out. And so I think he got it there. But he wasn't effective in staying out of the corner, so to speak, because he's not a rope-a-dope. He couldn't rope-a-dope to the corner and then come out with a Gingrich right hook that just levels him, right? He couldn't do that.
Yeah. Well, it was like you watch 5 minutes of this back and forth on Afghanistan, and you're learning all sorts of, wonderful details and stuff like this, and their command of the subject and everything. And what the whole nature of the debate comes down to is Ryan would have done the exact same thing. He just wouldn't have verbally said out loud when the date was. Oh, okay,
yeah.
Well, Romney Ryan.
That's a huge difference.
I mean,
that's a huge difference. Pretty, fantastic.
Well, that subtlety is lost on the vast audience watching this of what that really does to the tactical advantage and strategic advantage of being at war with someone, right? If you advertise your date, let's say, all right, we all agree we're going to be out on this date, and that's our objective, but that's not our line in the sand. We got to be gone, and it's just going to happen no matter what, right? You don't talk to it that way because you let your troops have the advantage of drawing out the enemy and prosecuting the war to the best of their abilities in any way that they can while they have the opportunity before they're drawn down. Right.
You're assuming that the enemy believes you when you tell them that this is the date you're pulling out, which they probably don't. And B, this kind of enemy isn't really thinking in kind of massive formation military strategies. These are guerrillas, basically. So, the fact is that, look, go ahead, Doug.
The other thing is, if the plan is to get out, right, and you announce a date, now I don't think they should have announced it publicly. I thought that was stupid, right? But if the plan is to get out, right, and if announcing a date does mean that they'll just wait you out and then they'll go back and fight, well, you won't be there when that starts, right? So, hey, just everything quiet down real quick. You know, we're going to pack up our luggage here, you know, train these guys. All right, you guys are good. You go over in that province. Okay, everyone's in place, so we'll see you later. You know, and then they, it's like a bar fight. They go back at it. You know, it's like, okay, but we're not at that bar anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, Paul.
Kind of, it's okay. And so we kind of have to, you know, ourselves in our own way of thinking about things, we kind of have to put, you know, our own values around, you know, what's the objective then? And what do I want to have as a president to prosecute the objectives that I personally want to see over there? Do I want to see when we leave, it's stable enough so that, you know, let's say, as an example, the non-combatants are safe enough to carry out their daily lives versus having the combatants just kill everything in sight because that's what they do, right?
Yeah.
There's that piece of it, right? I don't want to go too long on the war side of it. I wanted to get back a little bit to, you know, how we move forward from here in this notion of who's the candidate and why we need different types of candidates. So anyway, I'll get off of that point because that's come out of the debate.
Well, I just wanted to say something in conclusion about Afghanistan, which is that part of the problem with our involvement in Afghanistan is the reason we went there is because that's where bin Laden was, and that was the headquarters of al-Qaeda. And so in the course of trying to get him, which took us entirely too long because of certain screw-ups at Tora Bora, you know, we ended up staying there, occupying the country and trying to get out all the last remnants of al-Qaeda, because really what we were doing was looking for Osama bin Laden to get rid of him, because we never had a problem with the Taliban when, you know, the Pakistani intelligence was basically propping them up to take over Afghanistan. We never really complained. I mean, we had human rights complaints and stuff like that, but we weren't going to go do anything about it. It was only the al-Qaeda element that made us want to get involved. And then once we got involved, and you have planes blowing stuff up and tanks rolling around and helicopters doing this, that, and the other, you know, the local population gets a little agitated, like, hey, you know, there used to be a bridge here. Now there's just smoke and ruins. Hey, that used to be like a house, but now it's just smoke and ruins. And so then the Taliban, you know, elements of them, start allying with al-Qaeda. Now, they did invite them in, but they become, you know, our enemy. And so now we have to stop the Taliban. Whoa. You know, they're just doing the old my enemy's enemy is my friend type thing. And maybe if you weren't there, they could just go back and kill the other local warlord that they don't like they've been doing for 1,000 years, and, you know, we can just, it's not even our problem.
Yeah, it isn't our problem, and that's why I think that, you know, let's be a little bit more strategic. I mean, I'm 100% for the fact that we went in Afghanistan to get al-Qaeda ferreted out, and I think we could have done it much more effectively and much more rapidly if we'd really made that our focus and not got distracted by Iraq. And then after that, you know, leave it. We don't have to build Iraq into, Afghanistan into a nation. It wasn't a fucking nation before we got there. Why does it have to be one after we leave? Screw them, you know. They harbored al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda took us out. We took them out. End of story. We win, and we move on, and they can rebuild their own nation or wallow in sand pits if they want. I don't really care. Tex, we've got a new caller on the line. Trog is here. Hey, Trog, how you doing?
Hey, what's going on, Trog?
Causing trouble. Hey, guys. Causing trouble across the nation.
Good for you.
I totally – yeah, well, I can't help it. I concur with everything you guys are saying. There's nothing. I mean, I didn't watch the debate. Sorry, I'm a bad guy, but I was doing an interview. But there's no difference between these two parties. Zero. It's just like what you were saying earlier when Paul was talking that you know, you just spun around. They spun around in circles and basically said the same thing. You know, the only difference was one guy said we shouldn't have said anything, and the other guy said we did say something. Bottom line is it has to change, and they're back to this concept of competition. I am fully behind, you know, these third party growing. I'm fully behind the Ron Paul people doing what they believe they're supposed to be doing inside of the RNC, whatever. They got, you know, you can't tell them not to do that. They've fought for years to get, you know, to do what they've done. And let them fight, you know, let them keep fighting. People are going to find their places, you know, they're going to, and I do love the fact that they did have great things to say about the Constitution Party and Virgil Goode and the platforms and the principles. So that was pretty cool. But we are in a unique time. There's no doubt about it. And I'm excited to see where it goes and how it, let's put it this way. Let's see if it shakes out soon enough. Because we're at the end of the clock, you know. Who knows what's coming in the next 2 years? But somebody's got to make some changes in the next 2 years. Because four years, I don't know. I don't know about
specific changes. I'm kind of tired of these unspecified random changes. We need some specific changes. And those specific changes are called "Get back to the Constitution, you friggin' fools."
Yep.
Well, you know, one thing that came up that was specific, and I kind of surprised I heard of it first in this debate, was that Ryan, they started talking about the budget, and Biden was talking about, you know, well, you guys are going to go in and raise military spending by whatever it is, $2 trillion or something. I don't believe Joe Biden when he says that. But, of course, if you are going to build the exact same number of ships we had in 1916, I could see how that could get expensive, considering how expensive our ships are nowadays, given the amount of firepower on them. But, you know, Paul Ryan countered with, what we're going to do is they're going to cut taxes and remove the deductions. Now, that's what Romney said the other day, but there are no specifics around it. Okay, so this time there's specifics around it. So he said that we are going to lower the rates by 20%. Now, Joe Biden said in response to that, that those are just tax cuts for the wealthy, which is always what the Democrats say, and you just roll your eyes like, I'm so sick of this bullshit argument. And then Paul Ryan says, I mean, literally this is a quote from the thing, he says, we start with the wealthy. I was like, oh, my God, why did you say that? Like, you idiot. You know, right now, he's in a room somewhere, they're hitting him with like a fire hose of water, and they're beating him with a rubber hose. Like, why did you say that, you idiot? But, then what he said is we're going to eliminate deductions, right, and that will broaden the base, right, because by eliminating the deductions, you broaden the tax base, and by lowering the rates, you make up for the loss of deductions, and so you can make sure that it's essentially revenue neutral and the economy is growing and you start getting more revenue, right? That's the idea. Okay, well, here's the problem with that. What loopholes are you going to be removing that's going to get that kind of money? I mean, if you drop rates 20%, that's a lot of percents, right? So you got to start looking at some pretty serious ones, and one of the ones that have been talked about is the home mortgage deduction.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're going to do is start means testing the home mortgage deduction and all this kind of
stuff. They already do.
Yeah, so there you go. They're going to start screwing around with that. And then you know what they're going to do after they have removed all the deductions and loopholes and whatever the heck else they like to call them, and lower the rates, once all the loopholes are shut down, then they raise the rates.
Yep, and Tex, as far as the mortgage goes, you know, you can only deduct interest, mortgage interest, on the first million mortgage, and then another $100,000 for equity, for, you know, home equity line for improvements, and of course that is subject to limitations based on income. Here's the problem with that. If someone can afford $1 million mortgage, maybe they can afford a $2 or $3 million mortgage. And if they did that, then maybe they would buy another house and help the real estate market. But if you start limiting those things, wealthy people aren't going to invest in real estate because they can't leverage it.
Well, this
so what they're going to do
is something Obama said about eliminating the tax break to own a private jet, right? Okay,
mm-hmm.
Well, what about the people who work in the factory that make the plane?
They're screwed.
Right? Yeah, if you eliminate that deduction, they're not making planes anymore, right? So now there's no jobs.
Yep.
And you know, I mean,
you're absolutely...
do they think about this stuff?
No, they don't think about this stuff, and you can tell because they both gave it away. Because what is never challenged is when they say, okay, you're gonna lower these rates, how are you going to pay for that? Wait a minute. If you're collecting taxes from me and you're going to collect less taxes from me, what do you have to pay for? I'm merely being extorted for less money. What do we have to pay for? What they mean,
exactly.
This is what they mean. They think that your money is actually theirs, and they're allowing you to have it. So when you think, oh, I'm in the 28% tax bracket, okay, that means you're assuming that on the margin you're giving away 28 cents for every dollar that you earn. But that's not the way they look at it. They look at it that we're letting you keep 72 cents. You should be happy that we're letting you keep 72 cents. That's what they mean by, you know, if you're going to cut revenue, how are you going to pay for it? Hey, here's a really good fucking idea how to pay for the revenue. Stop spending the money. It's not yours. It's ours. But they never talk about that.
Rex, that's what I was going to say. It's like, okay, so I'm going to pay for it by removing the deduction, okay? Why don't you pay for it by cutting the fucking spending? I mean, I don't know. Just throw that on the table. Hey, Congress, what's going on? What are all these bills we're passing here? You know, it's ridiculous.
And that's precisely why there was nobody else in that debate today. Because, I mean, you know, why wasn't Jim Clymer up there? You know, and the reason. I don't think he's anybody's vice president. If he's on a ballot, he's at the top of the ticket, so he wasn't invited tonight.
He might as well
tonight.
Just sat there and just, you know, hey, by the way, you guys suck. Here's the following reasons. Why are you here? Because people like me.
Yeah, people trust me. So, you know, when the moderator gives you guys a pass, I'm just going to walk up on stage. I'm going to bitch slap the both of you and say, shut the fuck up, you're wrong. Because that's
read
the way I roll.
I'm
Ron Paul. That's the way I roll. So Chris, I'm going to go ahead and grab some of our other callers. You got anything else you want to throw at us?
No, you actually. I was going to ask Tex a question, but he actually answered it. It sounds like they're playing around with that conversation where we're going to cut taxes, but we're going to cut loopholes. And I was going to ask the question about, is that including all the corporate welfare that we do? You know, there's so many games going on, you know, and so many, you know, federally funded free enterprise projects, you know, this new socialistic free enterprise system that we have, you know, that's until you break that, until you just stop that, none of this is ever going to change. It's just smoke and mirrors.
Tex is very annoying that way. He tends to answer questions before they're asked. It's amazing. It's like he's psychic or something. Go ahead, Tex. Answer another question he hasn't asked yet.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, people like to talk about, particularly on the Democrat side, well, if we just went back to the rates that Bill Clinton had, we would all be fine, right? Because, look, we balanced the budget back then. Yeah, well, you did that because of Newt Gingrich. I said this over and over again. It's not because of Bill Clinton. It's because of Newt Gingrich. It's not because of your stupid tax policy. Like, well, look at the tax rates of the 60s, right? We were doing good in the 60s. Yes, because we blew up all other sources of manufacturing on planet Earth. That is not necessarily a successful or repeatable business model, okay? I would not go back and say, hey, let's go blow up all the competition, and then we can tax whatever we want. We'll be doing okay because the world will have to buy our products, right? So back in the 70s when the tax revolt started, which is where Ronald Reagan got his momentum, was riding the heels of the tax revolt, the rate was, the top rate I actually saw in 1979 was 79%. And because I know someone who has a lot of accounting books, and I saved the one from 79 because they couldn't believe it was that high, right? And the thing is, the rate was 79%. They're like, but we made enough money and the economy was doing fine. Yeah, well, here's the deal. Everything was deductible back in the 70s. You could deduct everything.
Yep.
The interest on your credit card was deductible. Every single thing in the economy is deductible. So the rate might have been 70%, but nobody paid 70%, or at least no intelligent person. You know, they were deducting everything. So, you know, that's why I thought Gingrich had a genius plan, which is you can screw around 15%. With the current tax system. I'm not going to try to change it. Or you can just pay the flat 15%. It's your choice what you want to do. And I thought that was brilliant. Actually, I'd like to get rid of the income tax altogether, but it's so ingrained, it's hard.
Well, you can get rid of it. It just takes will, because remember something. Back in the 50s, the top marginal rate actually was 94%. 94%. And either of you guys ever see the movie Casablanca?
Yep.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Who was in that?
Humphrey Bogart.
Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, right? But you know that Humphrey Bogart was not the original choice for the role of Rick Blaine? Do you know who was the original choice to play the role of Rick Blaine?
Mel Gibson.
Ronald Wilson Reagan.
Yeah.
He was the first choice. Yeah. Now, do you know why? It would have been a different movie, right? But you know why Ronald Reagan turned down that role? He'd already made a couple of other movies that year, made some money, and checked with his accountant, and his accountant told him, well, you could do this movie, but basically you'll be getting paid 6 cents on the dollar. And Reagan was like, I'm not going to work for 6 cents on the dollar. Who in their right mind would? And then that marginal rate you were just talking about, that 79%, that was brought about by that tax-cutting, cold warrior, conservative bastard, John F. Kennedy. Interesting, right?
Yeah.
He brought it down, and we had a kind of a stimulus from the tax cuts. And Reagan saw that, and Reagan also remembered that he was getting 6 cents on the dollar. So when he came in, he dropped rates to the low, low, low rate of 50% for the top earners. And then in the 86 bill, where all those deductions you were talking about were removed, they brought it down to 28% for the first time. And it stayed there until Reagan's partner in crime, that guy who loved Reagan's voodoo economics, told us, read my lips. Is that what he said, Tex, or did he say something else?
He said, eat my shorts.
Eat my shorts. Here's some friggin' taxes, right? So here's the issue with all this taxing garbage, okay? You have to understand, and I believe that Biden and Ryan both betrayed themselves because they made it very evident that they believe that all the money out there is theirs, and they let you keep some of it if you behave well. Okay, so they're going to cut your tax rate if you eliminate some deductions, which means they're managing your behavior. Like, well, we'll let you keep more of your money, but you can't buy more real estate. We'll let you keep more of your money, but we don't want you – go ahead.
You know, the perfect example of that is during World War II under FDR, the father of, well, of American socialism, essentially, during the war, he raised the top income tax rate to 98%.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to raise it to 100%.
Yep.
And the reason he didn't raise it to 100% is because he wanted to leave 1% for the state and 1% for the locality. Now, think about that. You're part of your community first. You have obligations. Your community needs things that it has to pay for and all that kind of stuff. But the federal government needs 98% of all the wealth in your community has to go to Washington. But you could spend 1% of what you of your taxes on your own locality. Good plan. Good plan.
Yeah, well, but Tex and Chris Chris, you can go now, and I just brought Robert on, so he'll go after you go. But just clearly, the reason that they think that all that money is theirs and they're allowing you to keep some of it is because it is. Actually, it's not the government's money. They're just the agent. If you actually take out your money and look at it, it says right on there, Federal Reserve Note. It is a debt obligation to the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank. So they are right. It's their money. They lent it to you. You worked your ass off for it, but that's just because, you know, slave labor. And then they lent it to you, and now they're saying, well, you know, the Federal Reserve lent you all this money, but we need some of it for the programs that we're doing, so we're only going to let you keep some of this because really it's our money. But by the way, when the debt needs to be repaid, we're not going to repay it back. We're going to tax your children. Go ahead, Chris, and then we'll throw it to Robert.
Well, one of the things, too, a little bit of an economic lesson spinoff on all the interest deductions that you guys were talking about and Tex was articulating is that in that era, and I remember that when I was young and my parents, every flipping thing you bought, your house, your boat, your car, you know, your interest on your credit card, everything, that was also the era that also embedded the indebtedness habit into the American public. Because one of the ways they got you to get on revolving credit, to take loans out on everything, because the generation before that, when my parents were young, they saved money and bought things with cash outside of their house, you know, and that you went down and maybe got a partial loan from your credit union to buy a car. And so what happened was they gave all these deductions, so it made it viable in a high tax zone for you to go in debt to buy all these lifestyle things. Then they gradually took away all those deductions, but the habit was still established, and it's never changed.
Well, that's precisely why the Greenspan bubble that was created to offset the dot-com implosion was for people to just, you know, violate the hell out of the equity in their homes, leverage it, get more loans, buy more shit, and then when it all came crashing down, you're like, oh, crap, I can't sell my house because I owe $500,000 and now it's only worth $325,000. Right. Yeah. That we have learned to live beyond our means because they debase the value of the money so quickly that if you don't spend it now and if you don't leverage it now, it's worth nothing in the future. They are stealing from you right before your eyes, and you keep voting for them to steal and plunder from you some more. It is time to break that system, because all you have here is criminal government, and your options are, you know, criminal government with Obama Biden or criminal government with Romney Ryan. Either way, they're going to rape and pillage. Robert, you are live. This is Robert Jetter from Bard's Logic Political Talk, airing on Blog Talk Radio, Sunday through Thursday, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Rex. Hey, Tex. How are you guys tonight?
Good. How are you, Robert?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Doing good. I woke up breathing this morning. And that's a good thing. It's a good way to start the day.
Yeah, doesn't hurt.
So, and hey, Chris. Yeah, it's we had two folks on. We had it was Pepper. I keep forgetting her
Draper.
Last name.
Draper.
I feel, Draper. Yeah, I kept calling her Pepper all night, and I kept calling Gilbert, Mr. Gilbert. So I kind of felt bad because I forgot her name, but it was a lively interview. I'd have to say, they were talking about, I'm sure Chris and I mentioned some of it. About between third parties, and they're saying how, the Ron Paul movement is the new third party. I somewhat disagree with that because I think it excludes other parties such as the Libertarian Party, the Constitution Party, and the Green Party, which I'm glad to hear more talk about the Green Party just because, you guys know about my environmental leanings. I like
they're
to see
not
the
environmentally
more,
leaning. They're to, not environmentally
well, I said,
leaning.
I
they're
said
so
mine. I know, but I'd like to see some changes in the party, of course. I'd like to see a conservative Green Party. Hey, we can all dream, right?
Start one up.
you
and three members can storm the castle.
Like watermelons.
Exactly. No, you guys would be green all the way through. I'm just busting your balls, right?
Yeah, I know, man. It's okay. But no, talking about credit and things of that nature. I remember my mom used to say all the time that it's like, only the credit card folks, they don't make their money off of the rich people. They make their money off the middle class and the poor. And I somehow think that it was set up that way. For that, because she's like, if something ever comes up, you have to, someone with, and I'm not doing class warfare. My mom was not like that, but she said they just be able to go out and pay it, but then someone has to use credit, and then they have all these credit, credit card debt, and that's how it's set. It was set up that way. Mm-hmm. So that's just something that she used to always say, and I see some validity in it, in that statement and about the debt. And then, I've just seen that in 1 year, talk about the housing bubble. I've seen one, just in 1 year, we lost my wife and I, we lost like 10% in the value of the home. Cause we're thinking about expanding, get a bigger house and, have a bigger family. So you have to get a bigger house. But yet when, you think you have so much equity in the home, and then in 1 year's time, your equity decreases by 33% because the value of your home decreased 10%. It's just a mess in that.
Well,
so.
Robert, what you're saying is something that, they've talked about the housing crisis, and they talk about, oh, my God, all these people are underwater on their mortgages. They bought a house, they paid this much for it, but it's dropped in value so much that now they're underwater in the mortgage, right? Well, here's something I'm curious about that. When you go buy an automobile, if you buy it off the lot, when you drive it off the lot, it loses, 25% of its value, right? But nobody's like, oh, my God, everyone's underwater on their car loans. What are they going to do? You pay the payment. That's what you do, right? So presumably if you bought a house, you're going to be hanging around in the house for a while, right? Because it's like a 30-year mortgage thing that you've signed on to. So I assume you're going to be around. So what difference does it make if, the value dropped after you bought the house, if you're still going to be around? Now, of course, it's problematic if you're trying to unload the thing, but, it's sort of, I don't know, I always thought it was a very odd point to make.
Well, it is an odd point if you're sticking around, Tex. But like you said, if you're trying to move or you're trying to upgrade, then it makes it a serious problem for you, because then you got to pony up the delta before you can even get the down payment for the new place. And most people use their home equity as the down payment on the bigger place. But the fact is, this is symptomatic of exactly what the Federal Reserve does. It creates moral hazards. So the artificially low interest rates on mortgages and the artificial inflation of demand caused housing prices to rise. So you create foolish behavior, and then the whole thing unravels. So you get this boom based on a moral hazard, and then you get the bust because you can't extend valueless wealth for too long. But what they do is that they get their spread on the up and the down. They short it one way, and they go long the other way, and they're reaping massive profits at your expense. And this is why Ron Paul was talking, he talked about this in the debates, but unless you understand economics, he just sounded like he wasn't making any sense. In simple terms, if you want a robust and growing economy, you have to do two things. The policy that Tex was talking about earlier, which is just blow the fuck out of everything around the planet, and that therefore you have a monopoly on any manufacturing capability, in which case you'll have your wealth. Or two, you have to have a stable currency and true economic growth that's reasonable and based on real wealth. But what they do is they fake it. And every time they fake it, they create a bubble, and then the bubble bursts. And then, of course, Washington has to come save us from the bubble. But who do they really save? Because, everybody who's underwater in their home, you haven't been saved. You didn't get a bailout, but your lender did. So that's the name of the game.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're talking about. And that's what fosters the
lawful. You know who paid for your lender's bailout? You did. Yeah. So you bailed your lender out, but you didn't bail yourself out. So
that's
a wonderful system there.
And that's, I think, that's the system we're trying to break. And we think, we're taught to think in silos also. We're taught to think economics is one thing, social values are another thing, politics is another. It's all of a piece. It's our country and it's our way of life, and there are people who are raping us, and we keep voting for them. And until we stop voting for those who are plundering us, we're going to keep getting plundered until there's nothing left to plunder, in which case they'll say, okay, we've plundered them enough, now we can kill off half of them. And that's just typically what happens when tyrants rule. I just brought in a great patriot who broadcasts on Blog Talk Radio under Constitutional Conservatives Unite. Sam Sanford is here, and he has joined us. Hey, Sammy, how are you?
Hey, Rex. Hey, Robert. Hey, Tex. Hey,
hey, Sammy.
But looking back at that debate, I mean, that was the biggest joke. I mean, that was
the second biggest joke.
Yeah.
Biggest joke was last week.
Yeah, the presidential one was awful. It was awful. I had to force myself to watch that to
fell asleep during the presidential.
You actually had to extract the questions out of, I was trying to get the questions out. You actually had to extract and make up your own questions, because the guys how do you compare yourself
to Mr. President? You want to respond to that? There was no.
Did you watch the whole thing?
I watched the whole debate, and I even downloaded it so I can
watch it again.
Well, you know what I'm looking forward to is the new lip sync version of it.
But
what version of it?
Well, those videos that I've been posting, the bad lip sync.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just put that one with Biden up, but I can't wait because they did the one on the presidential debate. You know they're going to do one on this vice presidential debate. It's going to be hilarious.
Oh,
probably more truthful, too.
We can look forward to that. But, Sammy, was your impression of the debate?
Sorry, Sammy.
My impression of the debate, it was a bunch of bullshit, but I believe Biden won the debate. I think Paul Ryan hurt the Romney campaign, which is fine with me because we already knew the fix was in anyway. But y'all were talking about tax breaks. Do y'all remember back in the 90s when Slick Willie was in office, he imposed those luxury taxes on yachts and stuff like that? Y'all remember that?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
And right here in Jacksonville, there's a big yacht company called Huckins. It's about a mile and a half from my house. I mean, they had to lay off three quarters of their people. And if you don't give the tax breaks to the wealthy, they're not going to go out and buy these high-priced items.
Well, funny you should mention that, Sammy, because I was saying earlier that Obama in that presidential debate said, well, I don't think that millionaires and billionaires, right? So always mix the millionaire, the guy who has $1 million, mix him with the dude who has $1 billion, you know, because I'm sure they hang out in the same social circles. Right? But all the millionaires and billionaires, you know, can deduct a corporate jet, right? I don't think that's right. Yeah, those guys flying around eating caviar on their corporate jets, those bastards. But what about the people who make the jet, right?
Right.
Those are jobs. American Aerospace kicks ass. Everyone on the planet Earth wants American Aerospace, right? So we got those jobs here. We got companies that make these planes. But, yeah, screw you. We don't want this. Don't they want manufacturing jobs, right? Good, high-paying manufacturing jobs? That's people who make airplanes. That's what they have. But, you know, it's this glib political bullshit that kills us because people are like, yeah, that sounds right. Screw those millionaires and billionaires.
Well, what do you mean by millionaire? See, this is the problem I have. Is a millionaire somebody who earns $1 million a year or somebody who has $1 million?
Exactly.
Because if a 67-year-old widow has $1 million that she's got it sitting in municipal bonds kicking off 4.5%, she's only making $45,000 a year. Are we going to screw her because she has $1 million net worth? Is she a millionaire? These terms they use. So who are these wealthy that we're
talking
about? On her way to bingo, she's flying in a corporate jet, eating caviar. I mean, you know, it's these terms they use in the debates, you know. Well, only for high-income earners. Well, what's a high-income earner? Because if you make $20,000 a year, somebody who makes $50,000 a year, that's a high-income earner to you. But I got to tell you, in certain localities, if you live in Manhattan or Washington, D.C. or Miami or Los Angeles, $50,000, that doesn't go that far. So who are these high-income earners? Why don't they ever give you any specifics? It's because they just want you pissed off at the people who make more than you do. And then when you make more, they want everybody else pissed off at you, and they want you pissed off at the guy above you. And as long as you're pissed off at each other, you'll keep voting for these morons.
This reminds me of a joke. It's a Russian joke. So Russian jokes are good because they're always dark. So they Anyway, they come up to this English person, like a genie or something, comes up and says, I'll give you 3 wishes, right? The English person says, well, you know, my neighbor has a really nice house. He's a respected member of the community, and he's part of the country club. You know, I'd like to have a bigger house. I want to be part of the country club, and, you know, I want to be, you know, well-respected within the community. So, boom, that's, you know, what goes on. So then they come to an American. They say, you know, hey, I'll give you 3 wishes. What do you want? It's like, well, you know, I want to be a rock star. I want to have, you know, a huge mansion by the beach, and I want to drive a Lamborghini. It's like, okay, great. You know, so there you go. Oof, you got your wish. So they come to a Russian, and they say, okay, I give you 3 wishes. And so the Russian says, my neighbor has a cow. I want you to kill that cow. It's the same thing with this class envy, right? It's just this limited, you know, thought where you don't want to better yourself. You just want to hurt the other person. And by the way, the great part of that joke is the Russian only used 1 wish.
He was economizing.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, and I think that's the point. I mean, when you say who won the debate tonight, well, we lost because the simple fact is that, yeah, they got a little specific with Afghanistan and Syria, and frankly, you know, I like Tex's policy. Tex, what did you say the new foreign policy was? I think you summed it up in 2 words, and one of them was an abbreviation.
Oh, fuck them.
Yeah, you know, it's their problem. Well, why are we involved? But when it came to tax rates, tax policy, domestic policy, they didn't talk about cutting spending. They talked about eliminating, quote, loopholes and about making sure high-income earners pay. Well, you know, that's a pretty ambiguous term. And let's be clear about something. With quantitative easing forever, thanks to Ben Bernanke, we're all going to become high-income earners. I mean, minimum wage is going to be $25 an hour pretty soon. So, you know,
do the math. We're all about to become millionaires.
Yeah,
I mean, seriously, we're all going to be millionaires, but loaf of bread is going to cost $2 million. But you know, we'll all achieve the American dream of being a millionaire.
It'll make the rest of the world right. The Americans are all millionaires. Yes, we all have millions of dollars, but they're worth nothing. Thank you.
Well, I do want to point out one thing Paul Ryan said that, you know, I thought was sort of a brave stance. Now, I don't think he necessarily came out as strongly as he could have on this point because he did not go into the broader explanation. But they asked him about when should we intervene overseas, and he said only when our national security is threatened, only when it's in our national interest, right? So, of course, you know, national interest, that's a term you can drive a truck through, but he's on the right path, right? And they said, well, what about humanitarian crisis? And he said, you know, essentially, well, if you make a decision to get involved in something like that, there needs to be a national interest in doing so. But he kind of waffled if you go watch that. But there, at least, I thought was one point where he was making that would be sort of controversial with the, you know, ordinary viewer at home. No, we have to go help everyone. The military should be feeding people and distributing grain or doing whatever it is they think we should be doing. But, you know, so I thought he did advance a cause and take a controversial stance there, a slightly controversial stance, but I don't think he necessarily did as much with it as he could have. And, well, you know, intellectually, I don't think he's quite there with the, if Congress hasn't declared the war, nobody cares.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that that controversial position is about as controversial as Gary Johnson's regarding humanitarian war. So I guess we're going to invade Uganda to get rid of Kony, and then we're going to have to invade countries in South America to get rid of this guy and invade other countries to get rid of that. Where does it end? Where do you draw the line? When do you start picking which genocide and which Holocaust you're going to help and which one you're not? How about furthering the cause of liberty at home and liberating the American people? And then maybe those other people will say, hey, you know what? Screw this warlord. We want what the Americans have, you know, instead of us invading to help people, because we never know if we're on the right side of the equation.
Which is why the thing is, you know, if you go get involved in a Libya or in an Iraq, right? So, you know, Donald Trump said this about Libya, which is Gaddafi had defeated the rebels, right? And they were going to lose. And then the West intervened on the side of the rebels and got rid of Gaddafi. Okay, but much like the Taliban, well, not the Taliban, but the Northern Coalition, remember? In Afghanistan, mm-hmm. The Northern Coalition was holed up in that little, you know, I don't know, that peninsular-looking area of eastern Afghanistan, and the Taliban had everything else. So they basically were defeated, right? But we came and we basically delivered all of Afghanistan for them. Well, same thing with these rebels in Libya. The thing is, you can go to these guys and say, hey, we can win this war for you, no problem. But we didn't ask them for anything. We should have said, okay, we'll do this, but we want 50% of your oil revenue or something, right? If you're going to do it, you at least should be getting something for it, right? Now, that's very old school. I'm not saying you should go get involved in Libya. All I'm saying is if you make the decision to get involved, you ought to get something out of it, because otherwise you're just spending blood and treasure in a region of the world where it's just a money pit. And let me give you an example, okay? So back in the day, Portugal was a very poor country, much like today, but it had an idea, which was, hey, instead of sailing into the Mediterranean and going buying spices from the Venetians or going directly over to, you know, Istanbul or, well, back then it was Constantinople or the Middle East and picking them up, what if we keep sailing down the coast of Africa? And eventually they kept doing that, and Vasco da Gama, you know, showed up in India and was promptly greeted by an Arab merchant who said, the devil take you, how did you get here, right? And that was one of the major economic events in the history of the world, was the discovery of the passage to India, the sea passage to India. And they then sent a guy down there, his name was Albuquerque, which actually is what the city of Albuquerque is named after, but no Americans really seem to know this because nobody ever teaches this Portuguese history. But Albuquerque went, and he had a fleet, and he just spent years in the Indian Ocean, in the South Pacific, taking places over for Portugal, fighting with Iran, island off the coast of Iran he took over. He went up, spent some time over off the Horn of Africa. He went down to Indonesia, a bunch of other places. He took all this stuff over, and he was making money hand over fist, right? He was involved in the carrying trade, which is moving things between the ports of, like, Surat in India, moving it over to, you know, I don't know, whatever it was in Iraq at the time, whatever the coastal city was there. But, you know, so they would do this, and they were making all this kind of money. And then they got the great idea that they would just become like pirates, and every time they saw another ship that had cargo, they would charge them for not having a license or something on it. But anyway, so basically they're raping and pillaging the place economically. But the thing is, they sent all this money back to Portugal, and Portugal got all this money. And what they did with it was Portugal was very parochial, and they were very focused on the immediate battle that they had with the Muslims in North Africa, particularly in like the Morocco area. And they took all the money that they were making in the Indies, and they spent it on war in Morocco. But Morocco didn't make any money, okay? So they blew all their money fighting in Morocco and doing poorly, by the way, because the nobles there, they wanted to, you know, get noble titles and everything for being so great in battle and everything. So basically they completely squandered everything, and then there was this big whisper campaign against Albuquerque because everybody was afraid of him because his name was so big that if he came back, he would be the most popular noble and all this kind of stuff. So all these political jealousies came around. And so they basically recalled him, and, you know, he came back in disgrace and all this kind of stuff. And so the whole thing collapsed. But similarly, we are taking our country and all our blood and treasure, and we're pouring it into rat holes overseas that are doing nothing for us. And we got to stop. We got to cut it out, because you don't have an infinite amount of blood and treasure, you know, and quit wasting it.
It's a wealth transfer. We're transferring our wealth to other places, and the corporations and the banks that are transnational are making a little vig every time. Interestingly, though, Albuquerque did vindicate himself in the Battle of Lepanto, which was when the Holy League defeated the Muslim armada that was expected to be unstoppable, and he held himself up quite well in that battle, along with Don Juan of Austria and Hernan Cortes, who later liberated the Aztecs from the high priests who were slaughtering them by the tens of thousands here. So men of valor are always present, even if their governments are completely whacked. So our troops, like Albuquerque, are men of and women of valor, but the wars that they are fighting are for the corporations, and we need to stop that because their lives are far more valuable than corporate transfers, and they need to be here defending us from our porous border down south and the dangerous regimes we have nearby, like Venezuela, as opposed to liberating Middle Eastern countries on behalf of oil interests and other kingdoms like Saudi Arabia. All right, we're in the last half hour, and why don't we go to Chris and then Robert and then Sammy for final thoughts, and then I'm going to bring back Paul and Randy, and then Tex and I are going to take the last 15 minutes to close out. So, Chris, we'll start with you.
Wait, here, let me get – I'm just going to hop on and offline again, let my time go to these gentlemen.
All right, well, Sammy, thank you for calling in. Tell us when your shows are this weekend.
I guess are y'all doing one tomorrow night?
No, we are – Tex and Rex are broadcasting Sunday at 10 p.m. and then Tuesday and Thursday, and from Natal Election every Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday, 10 p.m.
Okay, well, I will probably do tomorrow from 9 to 11 then.
Okay.
Or
9 to 11
whenever.
Friday. Okay, 9 to whenever Friday, and hopefully we'll see you on Saturday too, Sammy.
Yeah, it'll probably be the same on Saturday too then. All right, well, y'all have a good evening, and keep up the good work, gentlemen.
Thank you, Sammy.
Thanks.
Take care.
Great. Bye-bye.
All right, Chris, and then Robert, thoughts?
Well, you just said something that, and I can't remember if it was you or Tex who talked about the war in Mexico was actually the first communist takeover in the world. And was that you, Tex, that was telling that story?
You mean in the Cristeros War in 1926? I don't remember talking about that.
Yeah, the revolution. Was that you? Well, no, I was just thinking about when you were spinning off about, you know, the border and, you know, dealing with Venezuela and protecting this. There is an uprising, and nobody seems to want to talk about it. I waited for 2 or 3 years in the news for anybody to even talk about the threat of potential terrorism coming across our open borders. You know, I kept going, why won't anybody talk about this? And the influence of Islamic extremists and communists in South America moving their way north. I mean, we're all over the world playing games in places where nobody wants us. And South America, there's something boiling down there big time, and nobody wants to talk about it. And it's just mind-boggling to me, you know,
well,
as part of this whole smoke and mirrors.
I'll tell you, this is from a government official, okay? So when they were doing the amnesty thing, right, back in, what was that, 2006, 2007, something like that, when they were talking about George Bush's amnesty program, right, and they had all those people out in the streets waving Mexican flags, showing, you know, hey, we're here and all this kind of stuff, you know. So I walked into this guy's office, he had the news on, and, you know, that's what was playing. And, you know, I mentioned that, you know, I don't think that's helping their cause, because I think a lot of people are seeing all these people on American streets waving Mexican flags, and their reaction is, oh, my God, there's that many of them here? This is a serious problem. And then the guy turned to me, this is a government official, and he said, well, they vote, so the politicians want their vote. Well, if they're a legal alien, they don't vote, right? But here's a government official saying they vote, because everybody in Washington, the reason that we don't close the border is because Democrats think that they can bring these poor, impoverished, illiterate, you know, uneducated Mexicans in the United States and get them on welfare programs and thus turn them into good voting Democrats. And the Republicans think that, well, their traditional values, Catholics, and therefore they're likely to identify with us on issues like religion and abortion, so we need to bring more of them in to increase the Republican vote. And so basically both parties are trying to get as many of them into the country as possible because they think they're going to swell their voting rolls.
Yep, and that's and the fundamental problem with that theory, and actually it's far worse than that, because while you occupy your warriors globally on behalf of bankers and corporations, you leave yourself vulnerable at home. And that's precisely why we had something developed a long time ago called the Monroe Doctrine. And to my knowledge, there's only one party that's actually addressing that particular issue, and I brought Randy back on because I think Randy would like to speak to that. Randy, am I correct?
Yeah, I would love to. But I did want to – I'm going to do something that the politicians do. I'm going to redirect here because I did want to say
well,
something about –
Well, you are a politician.
No! Ow! Could somebody pull this knife out, please? Because I did want to respond about the actual debate tonight. What's interesting is that if I was to select who I would support based upon solely the positions that they espoused, I would have to. It was horrible. You know, to try to make a total decision. But what was funny is Biden actually, if you guys remember some of the things I've said, Biden actually echoed some of the statements that I made. And one of those was regarding the timeline to bring out the troops. I said, look, you give a timeline, you give a specific date, and you say, at that date, I'm pulling out, the responsibility is yours. And, of course,
you know, Randy, I'm with you 100%. I thought
and
the exact
of course,
same
what
thing.
Did Ryan say? Oh, no, we can't give them a date because that'll give the enemy a chance to say, oh, they're going to pull out on this date. And, you know, just the insanity of what they're saying is so overwhelmingly ridiculous. And, you know, the other side of it, when Biden says, but I won't force my religious opinions on others, I'm like, yes, he is. He's forcing abortion on us, forcing the Catholic Church and the rest of us to have support abortion. So don't give me this crap about you're not willing to force your religious beliefs because, well, either that or you just don't really believe in your religious beliefs and it's just a bunch of crap.
Well,
but,
you notice how Paul Ryan jumped on him right after that? Oh, wait,
oh,
that
yeah.
Didn't happen.
Yeah, exactly.
That never happened.
You know, so...
Well, look. Randy, the fact is that you can always count on Joe Biden to say one thing and he means something completely different. And as far as that timeline goes, and I don't disagree with you in principle. I believe we got Paul on the line who might have a different view, but I don't disagree with you in principle. But the issue for me is that withdrawal date that we're all so excited about finally getting out of Afghanistan, that doesn't mean the troops come home.
Exactly.
Because all we're going to do is withdraw them from Afghanistan to send them into Syria or Iran.
Right.
It's not a withdrawal
yeah,
date. It's a transfer of theater date. That's what
yeah.
it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's so many things that I'd like to say, and I'm not going to take any more time. I did that last night, and I still feel a little guilty for taking too much time and kind of trumping some others. But, you know, the last thing I want to say is, you know, this idea that they can stimulate the economy with trillions of dollars, and it's like, okay, where the frick are you coming up with this trillion of dollars? Are you taking it away from me just so that you can give me a portion of it back? Or are you talking about printing money out of thin air, or should I say Federal Reserve notes, which have nothing to do with real money? So, you know, that I'll just end on that. There's issues about, it's bizarre that Biden can say that, you know, we have all this specific intel. We specifically know what they're doing with their nuclear power and exactly where they are. But somehow, you know, our federal government could not tell us exactly what happened to those weapons of mass destruction there in Iraq. You know, it's just this bizarre double talk that's always taken place. And this is why they expressly provided the reason why I could never support either of the two major parties. It's just a bunch of crap. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you, Randy.
Hey, thanks,
appreciate
Randy.
It.
And I just want to point out, you know, some of the kind of early reports of the debate are coming out, and we have one now from the online Wall Street Journal, which came out a little bit after the debate, and it says, Biden and Ryan slug it out, comma, differences on display. So you read the thing, kind of has a wind-up here. Americans want to know what a real debate sounds like. Joe Biden, you know, Paul Ryan provided Americans kind of stuff. Okay, so I'm looking for the differences. And we get down and it says, the vice president portrayed Republicans as opposed to the crown jewels of the Democrat Party, Social Security and Medicare. Quote, we will be no part of a voucher program for Medicare or the privatization of Social Security, he declared. The Republicans' plan for what their tax cuts will do for the economy are not mathematically possible. Okay, so I guess that's one of the differences there. And then he found ways to repeatedly drive home the fact that he's been around a lot longer than his opponent. Okay, I wouldn't say that's a difference. Okay, through it all, Ryan stood his ground. That's not a difference. And he subtly raised the question, was Biden being so tough because he's trying to make up ground for his boss, the president? That's not a difference. I know you're under a lot of duress to make up ground, Ryan said. That's not a difference. And that, in fact, will be the question. That's not a difference. Ultimately, it's likely that partisans of both parties came away pleased. That's not a difference. You realize this whole thing about the differences, it came up with one bit of difference, and it didn't even state what Ryan's opposition was.
There was no opposition. There's just one thing I'd like to say is that I did appreciate the spanking that Ryan got when Biden says, hey, by the way, you're so opposed to the stimulus, but yet you sent me an email asking for some stimulus there. I thought that one was great.
Oh, that was
awesome. Of all of it.
You know, I thought that was great, and then he kind of screwed it up a little bit by saying, hey, I'm always willing to entertain any letters you send me, right? Meaning, you know, now he made him look schmarmy too, you know, but anyway.
Right. Thanks again, guys.
Hey, thanks a lot, Randy.
Thank you, Randy.
Man, I can go for papaya right now.
Paul, you're on if you've got something about the debate you want to throw at us.
A little bit about the debate, but really what I was kind of glowing on to in the early conversations tonight, was about, where's the Republican Party going? Is it something we take back, or is it something we abandon and move forward with independent in another party? And I really don't have a strong feeling one way or the other. But what I do think about in trying to figure out how to go about getting the conservative movement in control, you might say, rather than say fractured at this point, is what kind of leadership we need. And focusing on, the different aspects of leadership and the personalities involved. Because, as we know, there's so much passion around some of the microisms or micro-demographics around, birth control, around, abortion, and your favorite subject. And it's all about leadership to, find a way to pull us all together. And there's going to need to be different forms of this leadership. Something that's really missing, except for a couple of key people who are not, the leading Republicans right now, or the voice of the Republican Party as it's seen today, is charisma. values. And this gets back into the Ron Paul thing. Well, Ron Paul, for me, after studying, like, you know, Chris and I talked about this, you know, figuring out what he's really all about, I have a very strong belief in Ron Paul and the movement that he has created. There's some things I don't agree with, but, you know, for the 80-90% case, I really like that. However, the man does not have charisma. It is the belief in what he believes in that his followers go to, and then they carry it forward in their own way. But what we lack there is the face, the voice that pulls that has that charisma to pull the many different factions of this constitutional conservative movement together. And it's not going to be one person; it's going to be multiple people. And we need to be able to have those people sit and strategize together with, I'd love to be part of that, but, you know, that's not going to be my role in life here. But how do we get those leaders to know what their, say, demographic of acceptance is, where they are accepted so that they can carry the message and spread it farther? Because right now we're fractured and we're not pulling that together. So that's where my head begins to kind of hurt when I try to think about what's next. But right now we know what's next. We've got to do something different. Well, and we talk about a lot of the little different things, but, you know, it's what are those leaders that we're going to rally around and to be able to carry that banner and message. They truly believe in what we believe in. So I'll stop there.
Well, I think the issue is that you stand for the principles and you take principled actions, and the leaders fill those roles. And I think the problem that we've had is that we play follow the leader. And the way that this country was set up by our founding fathers was not about follow the leader. It was about stand on principle, and the leaders will come, because what they will be is temporary citizen leaders, and then they will go back to their private citizen roles after they fulfilled their duty. And I think we have to get back in touch with that. And I think that's what the grassroots now has to do, is further the principles, and the leadership emerges. The problem is that the leadership that they keep foisting upon us doesn't have any principles. They're shills for the Federal Reserve and the corporations, and that's why we get endless wars, monetary debasement, plunder, and the destruction of our sovereignty. So I think that if someone is truly a conservative in principle, then further conservative principles and conservative people will step into those roles.
Yeah, I totally get that. And I think just a kind of a side thought on that, I think the principle, the values and principles of the leaders that are being foisted upon us are about control and acquisition of wealth. And they don't have any moral principles or Christian values or constitutional principles to guide how they go about amassing wealth and say, not power, but inclusion and education of our founding principles in the Constitution. I think that's the difference there. Is our leaders are very good at amassing wealth and don't have any principles on how to do that. And consolidating and creating a power base without any, with total disregard of the people around them and the laws of the land and how to do that. It's those principles that I think are just, you know, they're on the evil, they're on the dark side. Hang on, I'll just leave it at that, sorry.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comments, Paul and Randy. And Chris, did you want to hit anything else before we go into the last quarter hour where Tex and I will wrap it up?
No, I'm sorry, I'm good.
All right. Well, thank you all for calling in, and thank you, Sammy, for calling in earlier. And I think we've got Robert Jetter back, and he didn't get a chance to chime in earlier. So, Robert, it is to you.
Thanks, Rich. Yeah, what happened earlier is, excuse me, I dropped my phone and it fell apart, and I had to put it back together. So,
did your dilithium, your dilithium crystal fall?
I had to put this is falling apart. We're talking about debates, and I just wanted to put a little reminder out there that there's another very important debate, in my opinion, even more important than the one we've seen last week, and even more important than the interview that was tonight, and that's the interview on October 23rd with Gary Johnson, Virgil Good, and Jill Steiner.
And Rocky Anderson.
Rocky Anderson. What's the name? I keep forgetting about the guy and the name of that the party. So feel bad about that, but
that's okay. Rocky Anderson is from the Justice Party, and he's, you know, like Jill Stein, they're representing the left side of the equation, I guess. And we got Virgil Goode, the conservative, and Gary Johnson, the libertarian. But I agree with you, that's the real exciting debate. And let's remember also that both Barack Obama and Willard Romney were invited but have not commented on whether they will appear or not. I strongly suspect mm-hmm. neither one of them will be there because they would actually have to debate. And that is the free and equal debate on October 23rd at 8 p.m. Central Time. It will be streaming live, and I believe C-SPAN will also carry it.
Well, I like the free part. But, yeah, I don't know. I think the left are like, you know, we got to have this, you know, what do they call that, you know, income equality and all that kind of stuff, you know. You can't enforce that stuff by law. That's always the problem, you know. Social justice,
yeah.
Right? That's why you have the Justice Party, because it's about social justice. It's not just
right.
that one person has more than the other person. Well, you know, I don't know. One guy invented Microsoft Windows. The other guy washes windows. So, you know, one guy, everyone goes to work and they turn on his product. The other dude can only wash so many windows in a day. So, I don't know. Maybe
well,
there is a reason for
Texas,
all this.
I think the free and equal part is that it's free and equal access for all candidates who have the ability
okay.
to acquire 270 electoral votes, but I do agree with you about that other misused phrase of equality where everybody's the same. Hey, let me clue you in on a little something. None of us are the same. We're all different. We have different talents, different lives, different experiences, and therefore there will always be some level of, quote, inequality. But we are all supposed to be equal before the law, and the law is the Constitution of the United States. But these morons, like Jack Ryan and Joe Biden, no, not Jack Ryan, Jack Ryan's from the Tom Clancy novels, Paul Ryan, the wrong Paul, and Joe Biden, they believe that they know what we need better than we do. Well, let me clue them in both on a little something. Fuck you. We know better. Okay, back to you guys.
So, you know, to bring it back to the debate, I mean, I think we saw, you know, here was the conservative candidate, you know, our big conservative choice get duped out essentially by, you know, Jolting Joe Biden, you know, Mr. King of Gaffes. Like I said, some of those gaffes, you know, those are on purpose because, you know, when he's got to perform, clearly he performs. And, you know, so our conservative guy just got knocked out. I would predict that Mitt Romney will come out of the gate strong again in the second debate, and then he will, you know, trip all over himself in the third one, thus setting up an Obama victory. But, you know, who am I? I don't know.
Well, we'll see what happens. But I suspect that, you know, Paul Ryan did his job tonight. He was not as proficient as people had hoped, and Joe Biden did his job tonight. He was better than people had assumed he would be. But frankly, I suspect that the discourse over the next few days will be that they were pretty evenly matched. And I do agree with you. I think that Romney will wallop Obama in the next debate, and then in the one after that, I believe Obama will come out of the cage swinging hard, and Romney will basically be running around.
This can't be happening, man. This isn't happening.
That'll be Romney.
Yeah.
Robert, anything else you want to chime in, or you want to tell us a little bit about what you got coming up on Bard's Logic next week, and then Tex and I are going to close it out in the last 10 minutes?
Well, I just want to thank you for having me on, and I'm looking forward to that debate, and I'm working on a few things. I don't have anything nailed down, but it does involve the debates, and so that's all I'll say at this time, because I don't have anything concrete, so I don't want to put something out
okay.
there and then, you know, happen to. But I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
All right. Well, I guess you don't fly by the seat of your pants like Tex and Rex. We always put out a topic and then just never stick to it. But, hey, we have fun doing it. But so Bard's Logic is, Sunday through Thursday, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern?
Correct. There might be some tweaking to that later. I don't know. I'm picking on that. I have just a few things that have come up recently that might affect the schedule, but I'm not certain yet.
Oh, we understand. We've been bouncing around, you know, Blog Talk Radio for a few weeks now, but we've settled. All right. Well, thanks, Robert. Thanks for calling in, and we'll see you on Sammy's until you're broadcasting again Sunday.
Yes, I'll be there Sunday. Thank you. Have a good night, guys.
And to that end, I will
you're
say
Robert.
That, again, Tex and Rex have bounced around a little bit, but we have settled, at least from now until Election Day, which is for all of you who are voting for conservative candidates like Virgil Goode or writing in Ron Paul, the election is on November 6th. For those of you who want to vote for Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, the election is on November 7th. So make sure that you go to your polling place on November 7th, please. We've been bouncing around a little bit, but we settled on Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday, 10 p.m., to about midnight Eastern time, and we may throw in a couple other shows in there if needed based on the news of the day. All right, Tex, we are in the last 10 minutes, so you want to bring it home and wrap it up about this debate?
Well, sure. You know, thoughts on the debate, I think I shared those, so I don't really want to repeat myself, but, you know, maybe a little let's stand back a bit and stare at the 10,000-foot level here. A year ago is when I started tuning into the Republican Party debates. And, you know, I was like, okay, we got to defeat Barack Obama. This guy sucks. He's terrible. We're going to completely win the field. Who's our guy? What are we going to do? Who's the person with the best ideas? When Gingrich said that he was going to run back in late spring, I was like, hey, Newt Gingrich, all right, I like him. You know, I'll be excited to see him. And then there was the problem with Mitt Romney bought his staff out from under him or whatever they did. And they're like, oh, Gingrich is done. So I was like, okay, well, forget about Gingrich, right? So I tuned in the first debates, and, you know, there were whatever it was, 8, 9 people up there, and started watching. And really, when I watched, at that point, the person I was for was Ron Paul, right? Because, you know, the Washington establishment, I know a little bit about. I have some personal experiences with it, not all of them pleasant. And, you know, it's just like, well, the establishment hates Ron Paul, so I'm going with Ron Paul, right? And so I listened to Ron Paul, but Gingrich would speak. And the reason I went to Washington is because Gingrich inspired me to go to Washington, so I'd listen to Newt Gingrich. And, you know, he's coming with this hard-hitting, very factual stuff, and I'm like, God, I love this guy. I mean, he's just awesome. Right, so the only people I'd really listened to when they were talking were Ron Paul and Newt Gingrich, and long about you know, towards the end of this month a year ago, I was like, all right, look, Newt Gingrich is going to end up being the nominee, right? And sure enough, he got ahead, and they carpet bombed this guy in Iowa, and he came back in South Carolina, and the rest is history. And now, you know, we are where we are. This was supposed to be the most important election of our lifetime. You know why? Because we're going to have a choice between conservatism and limited government, rolling back the government encroachment on our lives and taxes and all that kind of stuff, versus the Democrat-Socialist sort of takeover of the government is, you know, Daddy Warbox. The government is Big Brother. It'll do everything for you, and you have no choice. There's just a government program for whatever you want to do. You have to fill out all these forms and live your life this way, and government will provide, right? Well, that would be an important election, but that's not what we got. What we got was a predetermined non-choice. And, you know, I'm stuck in my house, sitting here watching this stuff, and it's just like, you know, it's on autopilot. You know, I can't get passionate about it. You know, you got to read the news of the day, I guess. But Obama's talking about Big Bird, for God's sakes, you know. Romney's talking about nothing. I mean, at least Obama has a topic. You know, I don't even know what Romney's talking about. You know, and I can't – how can you read this stuff? I mean, you have to get like a blow on the head before you – oh, okay, Big Bird. You know, oh, I care about that, you know. You know, I don't know. I'm just in a daze. But what I can tell you is, come November 7th, we got to find the sons of bitches that did this to us and get them the hell out of the party, or find a new party.
Yeah. And I completely agree with that sentiment. And for everybody who's listening, it's not either or. You know, we've been conditioned to think it's this or that, this or that. You have a binary choice, one or zero, A or B. The fact is you have a plethora of choices, and the choice right now is not Do you find a new home in a third party, or do you try to reform the Republican Party? It's both and. Because if you have a revitalized conservative Republican Party in the model of Reagan, Gingrich, and revitalized by the Ron Paul Liberty Revolution, and you have a real conservative party with viable down-ballot candidates like the Constitution Party, and even some conservative libertarians in the Libertarian Party, then conservatism will really become a force in this country again, and we can reconnect with the things that have always made us successful and jettison those things that always make us fail. You have to get beyond the labels and start looking at the real policies, not the rhetoric. Start looking at the candidates and their record, not the party they belong to and what they say. That is the way you reclaim your country, because we are not supposed to be ruled by our politicians. Our politicians are supposed to serve us. We delegate certain powers and responsibilities to them in order to help us order our lives together. But the power is always with the people. And at the local level, you are to exercise that power to build a better country for us all. And when I say that, it doesn't necessarily mean working in a soup kitchen, although charity is one of the virtues of this country, and you should do that. But the profit motive is also valid, because when you seek to make a profit by serving your fellow man and serving as many of them with quality and efficiency at a good price and out-competing your competition, everybody benefits. And the beauty of competition is that it makes all of us work harder and it makes all of us better. But our rulers despise competition because they don't want to work harder. They don't want to make things better. They just want to aggrandize themselves with power and wealth. And so they eliminate competition, which is why tonight we had two vice presidents, quote, debating, and neither one of them gave us any real specifics or a clear distinction between the two. Now, ostensibly, Paul Ryan is considerably more conservative than Joe Biden, but their bosses are not made more conservative or more liberal by either one of them. And the fact is that nobody bought a new car because it had a nice spare tire. So if the vice presidential debate is going to help you pick which ticket you're choosing, then I guess you're assuming that the president is going to be killed in office. That's a really stupid choice, because the fact is you're voting for the guy at the top of the ticket, and rarely do presidents actually get removed from office or pass away or get killed. It does happen, which is why you have a vice president, but it isn't that common. So you're going to get stuck with either Mitt Romney or Barack Obama. So frankly, what Paul Ryan thinks or what Joe Biden thinks is really irrelevant. The only relevancy they have is when there's a tie in the Senate or when we're having the next election. Now think of it this way. If Barack Obama wins, it means Joe Biden's going to try to run in 2016. Now let's face it. Joe Biden, he's pretty easy to beat if he's at the top of the ticket. So that would be wonderful. If Mitt Romney wins, Paul Ryan won't be running until 2020. So just do that math. Don't let the vice presidential, quote, debate help you decide what's going on here. Vote for the real candidate. If you happen to agree with Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, then vote for them. But if you do that, just understand something. That means that you are in favor of the 2011 version of the National Defense Authorization Act, which allows for indefinite detention of Americans on American soil. You're for Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve quantitative easing forever. You are for incursions into Syria and Iran, where we will lose blood and treasure and end up in a quagmire of a regional and possibly global war. You are for taxes that plunder you and inflation that destroys any savings and wealth that you have along with your home equity. If you're for these things, then I suggest you vote for Romney Obama. If you're not for these things, then I strongly suggest you let them know you don't want these things by voting for somebody else. And one point I'd like to bring out, and this is very important because one of the prizes in political discourse is going for the Catholic vote. So they gave us two Catholic men, and they both talked about how their religion informs their policies. Let me be clear about something. Neither one of these guys is advocating for any policies that are Catholic in any way, shape, or form. So if you're a Catholic voter, you're the prized goal in this fight. You can't vote for either one of these guys. They may be personally Catholic, but their policies are quite not. So I need you to really think about that. And as always,
It's about liberty. You are not to impose your will on others, and you do not have the right to elect people who will impose your will on others. It's about the Constitution, and it's about plurality. If you want to be a free nation, vote for the Constitution. Vote for liberty. This is Tex and Rex, signing off.
The flames of liberty will never die. Until next time.